Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing artificial intelligence and African development. I'm joined by a very special guest, Ms. Susan Otieno. Ms. Otieno is an AI researcher based in Kenya. She's also a former head of litigation at Wasuna & Co. Advocates. Susan, I'm very, very delighted to have you join me today, and I look forward to a very fruitful conversation with you.
Yeah, likewise. Looking forward to the conversation, and thank you for the invitation.
Brilliant, brilliant. So let me start. I've read somewhere that AI, which is artificial intelligence, I'll just use AI, has the potential to contribute trillions of dollars, I think about 15 trillions of dollars to the global economy. And you know, part of that, 1.2 of that is said to be generated from Africa. So definitely AI seems to present massive development opportunities. But how does this translate in practical sense? What are these opportunities? How can you define that in terms of
practical sense? So I think, rightfully so, there have been predictions and studies that have been done on the potential impact that AI can have in Africa. I think in Africa, we look at healthcare, we look at agriculture in terms of food security, we look at employment, we look at also just overall advancing medicine. And just creating a better space for innovation and potentially an ecosystem to thrive. So I think there's a lot of opportunities when you look at, so for example, in Africa, the median age is about 21, 22. Mm. And of course, we're aware of the high rates of unemployment in various countries in Africa. And so a lot of people are moving to digital platforms. They're on these platforms looking for opportunities. And so we see a lot more people engaging in digital realms and interacting with these AI systems and even from a point of recruitment in terms of resource, they are being filtered through these systems. So I think there's a lot of potential from a corporate governance, from even individuals being able to kind of get access the global economy and make some money, earn an income. And also, as I've said, in agriculture, healthcare. And I think it boils down also to just, for example, if I've just graduated from university or I haven't even gone to university, I'm able to start writing articles online. I'm able to just maybe become I can deliver, for example, with Jumia, I can deliver food, I can deliver product, and I'm able to earn something as, for example, maybe I'm getting ready to go to university or I'm just trying to make some money for myself. So there's quite some potential and opportunities with AI.
I think what we should have started is we take for granted that, you know, everyone knows what AI is. What is AI?
So artificial intelligence, it's a technological advancement that I think in the simplest form, it allows you to do big tasks in record time. So for example, artificial intelligence is kind of made possible through something called an algorithm. So an algorithm is code, and it's kind of a set of instructions that you will give a computer program that allows it to provide a certain output. And so what makes algorithms a bit more special is that they're able to absorb or, you know, take in, read through or filter through large amounts of data to identify patterns. And from these patterns, they then now identify or like provide an output. So for example, if you're a bank and you're about to launch a digital lending app and you want to be able to score your clients, you will use you can use artificial intelligence to provide you with a kind of filtering system so that you're able to identify who is eligible for a loan and who isn't eligible for a loan, as opposed to filtering through hundreds of thousands of applications from, you know, like humans filtering through those applications, which would take months, if not years. So intelligence allows us to do what we would not be able to do essentially like in that amount of time. So it effectively augments our capacity.
That is very good. We look at that benefits. And you mentioned when you started, you said it could help in terms of employment. But then again, from what you've just said now, using the bank app, it could be a case where we have AI filtering through maybe tons or thousands or hundreds of job applications. And then again, does that not have like an adverse a downside where people can talk about the human, it takes away, eliminates the human touch. And then again, creates unemployment, because then if you have to rely on AI, for instance, to do that, it takes job from someone that should traditionally be doing that. How do you balance that?
I think it's a very valid argument. It's a very valid concern. What we are already seeing that some jobs are being taken away, not just in the tech space, but in other industries as well. The way I look at it is there will potentially be, or there will be loss, but there will also be new opportunities created. And so it is for humans and for everyone to adapt and adjust and reskill and retool so that you're able to, you know, maneuver in this new space. And most of the time it is, and I saw an article today by the Harvard Business Review, they were talking about how being able to, it's AI won't replace you, a person using AI will. So it speaks to literacy, it speaks to learning to use these tools, it speaks to, you know, understanding how the like artificial intelligence will augment your capacity in terms your role, and then, you know, leveraging that. So there is an opportunity there. You know, I think it just depends on your perspective. So you can see it as a risk and then, you know, maybe react in that respect, but you can see it as an, you can also see it as an opportunity and say, okay, you know, there's this thing called artificial intelligence. Okay. You know, how can I integrate it into my business operations? How can I integrate it into my note-taking? How can I integrate it into, you know, the things that I'm doing so that it can help me as I'm trying to earn an income, as I'm trying to, you know, complete tasks in my job, or even as I'm trying to do research. There's so many tools now that are coming out. ChatGPT has just announced a new version, and we're seeing how that has influenced the academic space. So I think it's half and half. There are those people who feel aggrieved in that, you know, automation and all these technological advancements like AI are going to take their jobs. But there's also opportunity for new jobs to be created. And so where are you in that space? Are you adapting? Are you, you know, retooling and reskilling so that you're able to adjust? In the legal profession, we're seeing also the same thing in terms of now, you know, people are looking to ChatGPT for like case law, like things like that. And you wonder, it's not But you know, that's what's happening. And so you start to look at, okay, how is artificial, what is the impact of AI in the legal space? And how can I start to integrate those things? We have there's an app called Auto AI, which allows you to transcribe notes. So you can have your meeting and then have the notes sent to you on email. And, you know, of course, it's always better to have a written reference for your meetings and your notes. And so, again, it comes back to the conversation on, there's this change, there's this shift that is happening, and what is your response? And it's you're entitled to your choice at the end of the day as well. But I encourage people to learn about the technology, not just to, you know, kind of have this knee-jerk reaction of, oh, it's going to take our job. There's still opportunity for you to maybe even earn more income after reskilling.
Yeah, very, very interesting. There's so many things that come up from your, there's a question I was going to talk about the literacy, but I'll come to that in a minute. Now, when I used to expand on the adverse impact, well, you've mentioned one. Well, you've given another example, the ChatGPT. So Ibafid, as an academic, and you mark students' essays, I've seen where, you know, you even go on YouTube and somebody is advertising about ChatGPT that, you know, this can help you do your essays. And how does that? I think I wanted to just expand more the risk and how this risk can, because again, I think there's something that people are saying, there's a ChatGPT proof app as well that can, you can put in the essays and it will proof if it was ChatGPT. I don't know. Like, but how do we manage? What is the scope of this risk? I know we've mentioned ChatGPT, we've mentioned how it can, you know, take job away. What other adverse impact, like in health, for instance, in the medical field, even though you have to advance science, what are some of the risks that are in these different fields?
Yeah, so I think the primarily, and it goes back to the definition of artificial intelligence, it requires large amounts of data. And so we're seeing that one of the key issues that has been cropping up is privacy and security, data security. So when you look at ChatGPT, and there are a number of cases, the New York Times took OpenAI to court over copyrighted material in the training data that was used to build ChatGPT. And so we're seeing that, you know, these big tech companies literally went on the internet and just scraped. They took everything and then they used that to train their models. But what they took was protected by, for example, intellectual property under copyright. And they did not seek permission from the copyright holder for that. It's not proper. And the problem is regulation usually follows innovation. So you'll find that, for example, in the private sector, there are a lot of things happening in terms of advancements in technology. However, regulation, it takes a slower pace in terms of catching up and also being able to regulate the developments and the emerging areas. And so those are some of the gaps and the spaces where it's important for governments, it's important for regulators to come in and say, look, you can do this, but you need to have a process, you need to have a procedure, you need to respect the existing laws so that you're not just going about taking people's property, because intellectual property is classified as property. You're taking people's property and using it for your own purposes and then seeking to maybe make money, monetize, or commercialize the product that you end up creating. And so that's the conversation, especially with the large language models such as ChatGPT, that's the conversation. How are they training these models? How are they creating these systems? And is it in a way that not only respects the rights of others and the kind of property of others, but also complies with, even if it's the existing laws? So when you look at some of the cases that are coming up, you're seeing that even Hollywood, there was an issue with the writers where they were like, oh, now they want to use AI to, you know, mimic voices. And even Johansson recently came out and said that she was quite disappointed with what was happening in terms of her voice being used. So it's almost like there's this unfettered you know, exploration. But you shouldn't be able to use someone's voice, someone's face, just like that. There are laws, and there should be parameters for the innovation and the advancements that are happening. And so when you talk about the adverse effects, we see privacy coming out really clearly in that people's personal information is at risk. So for example, how can you identify yourself online? How would you be able to prove you are who you are online? There's an issue there. Children also, when it comes to the online age verification, how do you prove that? I can just go and click, say, yes, I'm 18. A 14-year-old can go and click and say, yes, I'm 18. So we still need to think about those things and think about this new, like, digital age that is coming. How are we going to engage in it? How are we going to protect ourselves? How are we going to enforce our rights as humans? Because the AI model, as it is now, it doesn't really understand us. It doesn't understand our context. And so there are situations where there could be discrimination of vulnerable groups. There even there are a number of digital ID projects that are running across Africa. There could be issues of discrimination because some of these communities either might not be able to access, you know, even if it goes to a government service, they might not be able to access these services. Going even to electricity in Africa, we don't have consistent electricity. Digital divide, rural to urban divide in terms of connectivity, infrastructure. So a lot of the times it's really, you know, there's privacy and security, but there's also the practical aspects. You know, do we have electricity to sustain these this digital first agenda? How do we ensure that the people in the rural areas are also able to access these digital platforms, access the global economy, and you know, eke out their living? So those would be some of the adverse
This is very broad. You've touched on some of the questions going to ask about the infrastructure limitations. But there's one thing you've hammered on the need for regulation. So if I look at cybersecurity, for instance, and I look at how it transcends a single border, and how it's difficult to regulate or to your lawyer to look at jurisdiction in terms of, like, if one crime is committed in the place and how, you know, the cybersecurity. So in AI, for instance, let's look at Africa. How is African government prepared in terms of are there existing regulations, are there policies? How effective are these? What are plans? Are there any plans in terms of agenda that has been set specifically for AI, whether at the AU level or whether at the subcontinental level?
I think first I'd like to just state that this is maybe in addition, because there are existing laws that cover cybersecurity. And because we haven't gotten into digitization this year, it has been happening for a number of years. And so there is legislation that has come in potentially across Africa, but I'm sure a number of countries have cybersecurity regulations. In Kenya, for example, they just published cybersecurity regulations that seem to address these issues of cybercrime, fraud, you know, all these things, and also cybersecurity. On the AU level, in the African Union, there is the Malabo Convention. And so the Malabo Convention is the African counterpart of the Budapest Convention, which directly speaks to cybersecurity and cybercrime and such. And so as it stands, the Malabo Convention is operational, and the conversation has been now to update the convention. Should there be now further conversation? Because at the time, there was no ChatGPT. There was generative AI. And so there is conversation around how can it be updated or amended so that it reflects the current situation with the emerging technologies and also the rise of some of these tools. I think policy as well. We have the AU data policy framework, and the AU has consistently come out with white papers, policy documents, and guidelines on not just cybersecurity, but on data and on currently there is conversation or discussion around developing a continental AI strategy. And so the conversation is happening and momentum is building. UNESCO has also come in to assist with a readiness assessment that countries can now do to see where they're at in terms of the capacity when it comes to artificial intelligence, specifically with regard to policy instruments and strategies and also how to look at regulation. And so I would say that the in terms of regulation and policy, Africa is catching up and it is beginning to think about how to approach regulating artificial intelligence, in what ways can a conducive environment be created so that innovation can continue, but they can now, you know, kind of look at what the parameters would be so that rights are respected and, you know, also in terms of public interest that... things are not just, you know, happening on really neat. In Kenya, we had the WorldCoin example where they came in to, you know, scan people's irises. It was a whole situation. And then the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner came in. And the matter was also before Parliament. And you know, it was a ruling came out to say that they had not followed the Data Protection Act 2019 of Kenya. And they were thereby asked to stop any further registrations. And so we see how regulation is coming in and legislation and policy is coming in to mitigate and address some of the challenges of this unfettered technological advancement by big tech.
It does feel like, so if we look at it, you did mention early on, and rightly so, that the continent has... I think it has the largest youth population. And I'm surprised you said the median age is about 21. I was thinking it was lower than that. I think it was around 16 or
19. I feel like 19 is so young, but it's 19. When you Google, it says 19. Even when you Google, it says 19.
Okay, so I guess my question is, so we see, like, for instance, in my recent book, I was saying the Africa way, the future of Africa hinges on the youth and women. And I say that because, again, we're seeing the industry such as fintech. We see, you know, youth population in fintech and all of that. But I guess my question is this. What is, first of all, we're seeing data and regulation catching up, but we've also seen a place where those are the helm of affairs in Africa, which, you know, compared to other places, Africa has like, African leaders are like, really like, for lack of what to say, you know, compared in terms of age, median age to other people are very mature, and they don't understand this space. And there've been instances like in Nigeria, for instance, there was a recent whatever laws that seems to like stifle these spaces or understanding this thing. So how do you see this dilemma being solved in terms of like we need fintech, but then again, there is the risk where it can be used for fraud in business. You see, maybe in Nigeria, I don't know, in other places, you see advanced fraud and all this kind of stuff. What is the scope of this, and does the regulation cover this? Is it catching up, or does it? How can you define this whole space of, you know, the risks it is in terms of financial fraud and how the government is dealing with it? Are they dealing appropriately with it?
I can give the example of Kenya. So we had quite a number of issues with digital lenders, and the space was. Like not really, not that much. It wasn't regulated, and so you would find that, you know, they get access to your contact list. They start calling everyone on the contact list and telling them how, you know, the money needs to be paid back, etc. And that's a clear violation of the Data Protection Act. And so what happened is that the central bank would then put out statements and also guidance on how the space would be regulated or handled. And after this, we then saw they would, I think, regularly they would send out lists of digital lenders who you could actually that the public could actually And then after that, there was now discussion on an act or a legislation that could then regulate the space. And I think it was really interesting because it was also at the same time that the cryptocurrency blockchain conversation was happening, and there was the introduction of a digital assets tax. And so with that introduction, then, you know, like the policymakers and I think overall civil society practitioners and also government were like, okay, let's have a conversation and start to think about, okay, how do we want to approach this? And so they put a hold on the digital assets tax and they engaged stakeholders in tech space. And they said, okay, hey, how do we go about this? And so there is the Blockchain Association of Kenya that was mandated with coming up with a regulation, a bill that could regulate this space. And this is also what we're seeing in the digital lending space as well, that they're engaging stakeholders, government is engaging stakeholders and wants to hear how best should we approach this conversation. And of course, Central Bank is also addressing any issues. And because we have now a strong data protection office, they are also coming in from the personal information lens to ensure that these digital lending apps are following the law, are complying. And as of last year, the regulator, the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner, did, they were, I think they were about, there was a penalty notice, and in total they were about like 9 million upwards. And so we're seeing that the regulator is coming in to ensure that these companies and these providers, digital lending providers, are towing the line when it comes to compliance and also when it comes to just having best practices. Because that's also what you do, you know, in lieu of regulation. You have best practices and maybe standard contractual clauses that come into place to just maybe hold the line before regulation comes in. And so, yeah, I think we are definitely also doing better in that space. And I think this is also trickling into like other countries as well, because people are aware that there might be a gap when it comes to regulating digital lenders, for example. So how does, you know, government come in to legislate and also maybe bring in regulators so that they can start to oversee and ensure that, you know, there's compliance and also that, you know, public is able to access the service without being compromised from a personal perspective, from a cybersecurity perspective, and also from a financial fraud perspective.
You mentioned earlier the need for, when you were talking about the benefits of learning the skills, AI for business, you did mention about the need to retool, the need to reskill. How much of this is being reflected in, let's say, for instance, in the educational curriculum, in terms of how much of this has been integrated, into trainings or skills learning, maybe in the higher institution or in other kind of like learning spaces?
I think what we're seeing a lot of is, so the government has committed to integrating coding into the syllabus so that younger people can start to learn how to code. We are also seeing that academia, in terms of universities, are doing various campaigns to create awareness around artificial intelligence, around data protection, around technology in general, and also digital skills. So, you know, how you can make the most of these skills and how you can potentially, you know, like commercialize or monetize said skills. The one of the regulators, the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner, has various campaigns in Nairobi and in Nakuru, Mombasa, Kisumu, where they do go out and create awareness about data protection. You know, what is personal data? You know, who is a data subject? Who is a data controller? All those things, the terminology, so that the public, the wider public, can start to understand what these terms mean, how they impact them, also understand the value of data. And so when you look at data and its position, its role when it comes to technology and, you know, the digital realm and also artificial intelligence, it's quite substantial. And so I think it's good to have this basic understanding so that you can always add on. And we're seeing other government agencies coming in to build awareness. And I think one of the other things that is quite crucial is for key stakeholders like government to build their capacity in how they understand technology, how they understand things like ChatGPT, how they understand generative AI, you know, platforms like Midjourney, how they understand these platforms' impact on things like, for example, copyright. So if an artist were to go to court and say that, this platform infringed on my work, they can understand how that happens and the technicalities. One of the examples that we're seeing is that private sector is also coming in to support this capacity building. So we have the case, the content moderators case of Somersault's Facebook, Meta, and the content moderator who sued Meta because they were the adverse effects that they were experiencing during the job. And and we had practitioners, legal practitioners with expertise in tech who would come in and join the case. So they join as something called amicus, so a friend of the court. So they would join and they would now kind of expand on some of the things that would come up and would be able to explain to the court that, you know, this is, you know, in this situation, this is what it means. And so the court, by virtue of that, is able to kind of take judicial notice of, oh, there's, you know, this aspect in technology, or there's this aspect with artificial intelligence. And so on a number of fronts, we're seeing that this capacity building is happening, although there is still quite a substantial amount that needs to happen with everyone, public, government, policymakers. Everyone needs to understand, at least from a basic level, so that they're able to make decisions and move from a point of information and are not, you know, kind of, you know, stabbing in the dark when it comes to either creating policy or, you know, in justice delivery. Yeah, it's quite crucial.
You mentioned earlier, you said, you said about the large amount of data that is involved in this. But then again, when we talk about that data, how much of that data, you know, like, it's focused or African-centered? So when I say that, how much of that is generated to that actually speaks to the need or to the, you know, of Africa? Are those data, are they externally driven? How much of that is internally generated? And what, you know, in terms of we could talk about capacity on one hand, how to manage this data, but where is this data being generated from? Does it speak to the African needs?
It does not. So currently, of the data that is from Africa that is being potentially used to train the models, it's about 11%, and it's coming from Egypt. And you can imagine that Egypt isn't really reflective of Africa. And 60 to 70% of what's on the internet is from the West, is from the global North, and it's in English. And so you can imagine what that model is being trained on. It's being trained on someone's or a particular area's perspective of the world. And I think two of the issues that come up with Africa is that we lack structured data. We have data, but it's not structured. So structured means that it has either been classified or it has been aggregated in a way that it can be used to train the models. And there's also a big conversation in Africa about how to create African data sets. So a data set is this large pool of data that is then used to train an AI model, for example. And so what are the considerations that we need to make when we're building African data sets? Saudi Arabia, for example, has built a bilingual large language model, an LLM, and they use 90 million or 90 billion data points, Arabic data points, and also 90 million English data points. And so you can see that by virtue of scale how much that is. So I think the conversation is happening, and there are people, think tanks and researchers thinking about this issue of data sets and other people building data sets. But we need to approach the conversation from, you know, our cultural diversity, our storytelling. What are we saying when we create these things? How are we capturing our richness as Africa, you know, as Nigeria, as Kenya, as Tanzania, you know? And so I think that's also the question, because we do have an opportunity to build these data sets so that we can join kind of the global AI discourse in terms of being represented and having an accurate representation. And one of the ways that that is happening is through language. So for example, Mozilla has an initiative called Common Voices, and they've just, so mostly, I think it started with Kiswahili, and now they've announced Luo and I think Kikuyu. And you know, progressively, they could add on other African languages. And what this does is it's inadvertently creating a data set. So what they do is they invite the public to come in and share their words in Kiswahili, a sentence, anything. So this is also a great way to engage the public so that they can start to learn why is it important for us to participate in this conversation on artificial intelligence, because it is our story, because it is an opportunity for us to be seen and heard in the digital realm, of which we will more and more be on. And with globalization, everyone is making sure that, hey, my story is this.
It's being told,
story is this. So it's an opportunity for us to also, you know, participate and participate from our perspective, because ownership is quite key in this conversation. And we talk about production and consumption. We are consumers at this point, but we can be producers. We can start with creating our own data sets. We can continue with creating conducive and enabling environments for innovation and build an AI ecosystem. And I think with the African Free Trade Continental Area, it's a great opportunity because it's housed on economic growth and engaging in the digital realm. So it's an opportunity for us as Africa to tell our story, you know, in our voice, not in, you know, someone else's voice. And so maybe from a storytelling point of view, this is what it means when we talk about being producers of AI. It means sovereignty. Its ownership. It also means having a positive and an accurate representation of who we are.
But before I come to the last question, there's I'm glad you brought up AFCFTA. I was actually going to talk about it, but I want to talk about it in combination with climate change. So we've seen, like in the Horn of Africa, in East Africa, I know Kenya as well. We've seen also in the West. You've seen a lot of climate induced conflicts. You've seen famine. You've seen all of that. How does AI help in dealing with some of these issues that could involve maybe food insecurity, migration issues, and all of that? And then, how does that, since you mentioned AFCTA, how does it help to facilitate that trade integration that the continent is looking to achieve?
Right. So my first example will be the recent floods that we've experienced in Kenya. I'm not sure if you had a chance to have a look, but it almost looked like Kenya was submerged in water, which we haven't seen in quite a while. And so at that time, there is this, it's called AI for Good Lab, or AI for Good Lab. So what they did is they basically are a team, and so they engaged with government and they mapped the flood throughout the whole period. They mapped the flood and identified the patterns, and essentially are working or were working to create a warning system so that we're better prepared for any floods or climate events that would occur. And so this is the same potential that artificial intelligence has when it comes to climate change. It can allow for early
Warning.
identification, early and warning systems, so that either governments are better prepared, and the public is also better prepared to deal with or to navigate the climate events. And also the meteorological department in Kenya, for example, they can use these systems to continue to derive data and also learn from it and also be better informed. And I think it's also interesting to look at it from like a energy and water management perspective, because in Kenya, our power is hydro, it's powered by dams. And so this has a direct impact on the energy. So if we're able to, have these warning systems and be able to identify issues early enough, we're able to adapt, and we're also able to ensure, for example, optimum water quality, ensuring that the hardware or the tools that are being used are maintained well. And I think it speaks to also sustainability, because you're able to maintain something throughout the course of years. And so, I think those would be some of my responses as to how artificial intelligence can support adjusting or adapting to climate change.
That's good. So if I come to the last question, and I ask if you take a very broad outlook and see, how do you think if you look at if your life being futuristic and looking at maybe in the next 10, 20, 30 years, where do you see the future of AI in Africa? How can African governments harness the potentials, the tools that AI offers, and how can they prevent the adverse impacts or the risk associated with it?
I think, for example, AI in public sector involves like collecting, analyzing large amounts of data, of personal data. And so governments, they have to ensure, like there's not just compliance, but there's kind of this culture and measures to safeguard this personal data. And it's going to take kind of even regulators, it's going to take a lot, like all like key stakeholders to come in to support this. And once this is done, or when there's an adequate regulatory and policy framework, then the space can thrive. Then people can innovate. Then people can experiment, for example, with regulatory sandboxes. And one of the like most staggering examples that I've heard recently is that out of the 1.4 billion people in Africa, there are only 3,000 pathologists. So this is an opportunity where we can use artificial intelligence to help in diagnostics. And so I think it's important to also look at the relationship between government and private sector, so that they're able to partner, to collaborate, so that we can address some of the challenges in Africa. And I think in comparison also, when you look at the West, it's mostly about efficiency and productivity. I want to, I'm using Grammarly to help me with my English. I want to schedule my calls. So I use Boomerang for my emails or Calendly. In Africa, it's necessity. We're talking about healthcare, security. And so our issues are different, but we do have a chance to address and harness artificial intelligence to help us in addressing these issues. Most prominently in healthcare, as I've stated, in agriculture, and employment.
Very good. I like the notes that you concluded on. That's very eye-opening. In the West, it's about efficiency. Here, it's about necessity. It's about survival.
Yeah.
So we need to go beyond that. I've really enjoyed this conversation. This is this is really, really very in-depth. Very, very in-depth. I'm glad somehow that we had a solo because there have been any room to have this rich conversation with juggling tea and meaning. So thank you very much, Susan, for honoring the invitation and sorry once again for changing the time. I'm really grateful. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners are going to benefit from this deep insight. I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you.
We'll keep you posted once this is going to be published, and then you can share among your network, and then we can help to spread the word and hopefully see us being efficient in the continent.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you once again, and have a good afternoon.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining in today. We've had a very exciting episode speaking about artificial intelligence and development in Africa. Join me as usual to thank our guest, Susan Etienne, who has provided us with very rich insights into these subjects. And I implore you to stay tuned next week for more rich and exciting episode. For now, take care.